Tonight is a celebration of the role of ideas in foreign policy and an opportunity to honor a giant of our age, a true scholar statesman, whose public life has been so animated by the value of scholarship in the service of the public good. So, we are continuing a tradition that we began last year with our memorable conversation with our inaugural honorees, George Shultz and Bernard Lewis. And let me just take a moment to note that Professor Lewis was supposed to be here this evening, called just a couple of hours ago to send his regrets. He has a cold and couldn't travel, but he dearly wanted me to pass on his regards to Dr. Kissinger and to all of us. So we're going to take advantage of this opportunity with our limited time, not to have a speech, but hopefully an instructive and enlightening conversation with Dr. Kissinger on a bit of the past, a bit of the present, and a bit of the future. And hopefully we can all end this evening a bit wiser than when we came here tonight. So, Dr. Kissinger, if I can begin. What did you tell Sarah Palin? Because you betcha she learned something.
Before I answer the question, let me thank you for this evening. I am very moved, not just by the honor, but by what you have said, and especially what Charles Krauthammer has said. He is, to me, the preeminent analyst and columnist of this period. And I read him every week with extraordinary attention. And it meant a great deal to me that he noted qualities for which I would like to be noted and not peripheral things. And for somebody who came here as a refugee, having experienced the fate of the Jewish people, and then to be permitted to participate in efforts to expand the cause of freedom, and in the life and death struggle of the Jewish people, was a blessing that fate has bestowed on me. And I'm very grateful to all of you for giving me this opportunity to be here. Thank you. Now, Sarah Palin. My basic view is that when you talk to high officials or aspirants to high office, the wisest course is to tell them exactly what you believe and to answer their questions. And Sarah Palin was projected in a very brief period into enormous prominence. And she's attempting to fulfill that role with dignity and intelligence. And she should be respected for what fate has brought to her that she didn't particularly seek. And I dealt with her and will continue to deal with her insofar as she asks me in that framework.
Let me ask a question which I'm sure if most people could ask you, this is at least high on their list. Given the vagaries of the world today, what is, in your view, the greatest security challenge facing America in 2008?
The greatest short-term security challenge. I mean, one could go on and talk about the evolution of the balance of power and the shift from the Atlantic to the Pacific and similar issues. But the shortest short-term challenge is the role of Iran and the role of nuclear proliferation and the impact of this on jihadist terrorism.
You've just opened up my next five questions. As Charles noted, your views on Iran are central to our presidential debate. So let me ask you if you can take a moment to expand on your view of how the United States can most appropriately and effectively prevent Iran from acquiring a military nuclear capability.
I begin, of course, with the proposition that the spread of nuclear weapons, if it is not contained, is going to bring about a catastrophe for mankind. Even in the Cold War, for me, the most difficult problem was when I asked myself, what do I tell the president? When he informs me that he has exhausted all recourse and he now has to use nuclear weapons, what would be my recommendation? Because the consequences of nuclear war would be horrendous and beyond the historic moral capacities of human experience. On the other hand, to acquiesce in ideology, the communist ideology, would be to open the world to potential genocide by refusing to recognize one's danger. But we didn't have to face that question, no matter what one reads today. We never came close to actually using nuclear weapons. But at that time, nuclear weapons were held by countries that had more or less comparable analyses of risks. Nuclear weapons are now spreading into the hands of countries in which suicide bombing is considered a strategy and in which the judgment of the value of human life has a different dimension and it's geared towards what happens in the next life and not in this life. Also, it moves towards societies that cannot safeguard nuclear weapons as the more advanced countries could. So for all of these reasons, to stop the spread of nuclear weapons now is an absolute imperative. We have, in order to do this, we have to get clear about a number of issues. One, how much time is there for diplomacy? In other words, when will a point be reached when the Iranian capacity to reprocess material has reached a level at which will be almost impossible to stop it, or where they will have accumulated so much material that they will possess enough for a destructive attack on enough of their neighbors. Second, what is the impact of their being able to do this in the face of a unanimous vote of the Security Council backed by Germany and Japan that they should not continue reprocessing. What is the impact on the international system if a unanimous vote of the Security Council repeatedly taken is ignored? And finally, how do we get matters to a point at which we can convincingly tell our public that we have taken every step to avoid taking stronger measures? So for all of these reasons, I have favored a willingness to negotiate the issue, because I think that the present course, where the three European countries, in effect backed by the United States, are conducting negotiations with marginal proposals followed by marginal sanctions, really plays into the hands of the people who are proliferating. So we have to get clear how much time we have. Secondly, what we should propose as an outcome, how much time we can give that process, which is related to the first point, and finally, what we are going to do if it turns out that the negotiations do not succeed. Those are questions that will have to be dealt with, in my view, within the first 18 months of a new administration. And in my view, there is no getting around them.
So the time frame is 18 months for resolution or decision?
Yes. And negotiation.
And negotiation.
I don't think one can hide behind negotiation. I think negotiation has to be part of the process.
Now, earlier you referred to the larger problem of Islamic extremism. I know that the candidate that you support in our presidential campaign, John McCain, has referred to Islamic extremism as the transcendent threat, the transcendent challenge of our age. You, as somebody who lived through the threats of first Nazism and then communism, how would you both assess the danger, and what strategies would you call upon from the past or new approaches to address this challenge?
Well, the international system with which we are most familiar, the one we learned in college, the one I taught in college, was based on the state. And the state emerged out of the modern state. Emerged out of the religious wars of the 17th century, when leaders assumed the right to convert societies to their religious point of view in order to stop the massacres that were associated with this process. They developed the notion of sovereignty, in which countries had authority to operate within their own territory, and in which foreign policy was what took place beyond the frontiers of states. The essence of jihadist extremism is that, one, it rejects the notion of the individual state. It is a universal philosophy that has to be generally applied to bring about the unified caliphate. It is aimed at all the institutions of the Muslim world, but it's also aimed at the institutions of the Western world. It has to reject, it by its nature, any idea of pluralism, because there is only one. There's only one truth, and therefore it is aimed at the institutions that have given structure to the international system, and therefore it is a threat to almost every state, certainly to every state that has Islamic minorities, but also to any state that can, in their view, affect the future of the Islamic world, which is a majority of the population in that manner. It is not. It is often presented as exclusively or primarily as a threat to Israel. That is not correct. I think in many ways they use Israel as a rallying point for a much more fundamental concern, which is to spread the notion of a universal Islamic empire. In the medium term, a successful jihad will threaten India as much as it threatens Israel, because the 160 million Muslims that live in India can not be unaffected by a wave that is spreading through the Islamic world. So that if Islam, and so I know in the city it's sort of fashionable to criticize President Bush, but I think he has understood what the central problem of the period is, even if one questions this or that tactical approach to it. And the central problem that we now face is Islamic extremism, for which the really only solution is to arrest it and to demonstrate its incapacity to achieve its objectives. Otherwise, the momentum is going to become stronger and stronger.
And so, operationally, what would your policy prescription be then to the next president on this issue?
Let me make one, I'll answer that question, but let me make a tender point. Even if you find this or that answer of mine unsatisfactory on tactical issues, it's hard for me to conceive, but assuming this happens, the key role of a president is to take his society from where it is to where it hasn't been. As an outsider, you don't have to have the detailed answer to every tactical question of how you would do certain things. What you have to know is where you would like a president to take this country, and to hope that he will make it clear through his conduct and through his instructions and through the system he establishes that we'll move in that direction. Well, the first thing we need is to bring the war in Iraq to the conclusion towards which it is now heading, and not to interrupt it by applying principles from our own domestic debate to a situation that is moving in a basically correct direction. If the situation in Iraq evolves as it is now, as it does now, then within a measurable period one can have an international conference on Iraq that establishes the international position of Iraq, which in turn would have the consequences of making it illegal to interfere across the borders of Iraq. Now, nobody will be restrained by the formal illegality of an act, but it will then create a basis for resistance other than the unilateral intervention of one country. And I would think that by the end of next year, we should be at that point or clearly approaching that point. Secondly, Iran presents a challenge not only in the sense of the dangers of proliferation, but also of the resurrection in Iranian minds of the ideas of Iranian empire, so that the reach of the attempt of Iran to lead both the religious upheavals and the various other revolutionary challenges in the region must be resisted. But we have to put this into perspective. Iran is not a strong country. Iran is a country with a reasonably strong ideology and with a long history, the only country in the region that in its present form has had a long history. So the challenge for us is this. If one were to talk to an Iranian who is not seduced by visions of Islamic universality, one could say, you criticize us for our relations with the Shah, but you misunderstand what that relationship was. That was a tribute to Iran. It was not a tribute to the Shah. That it shows that America can live with a strong Iran that is a major player in the region, provided it conducts itself as a nation and not as a cause. And on that basis, it could be possible either to come to an understanding, and it must be necessary for them to learn what the limits of Iranian reach are in itself on the basis of assessments of national interests. There is no reason for the United States to resist a strong Iran. Historically, Iran has had good relations with Israel, has had good relations with the United States, and so these are the directions in which we have to go, and I believe they are achievable. We must not let ourselves get mesmerized by the rhetoric. The majority of the countries in the region are on our side, and the extremists really do not have a strategy for achieving their objectives if we stick to a course along the lines that I have described.
You began your response by a discourse on leadership and the role of the president. Right. So I'd like to take a moment to go back in time, if we can. Tonight is the 35th anniversary of the launching of the Yom Kippur War. It is a moment when we can recall the terrible conflict in the Middle East, but also a moment that eventually set the stage for your diplomacy in helping pivot from war to peacemaking. So if you could take a moment and go back to that era, and if I ask you, who from that era of Middle East leaders did you find the most impressive politically, diplomatically, who would that be and why?
From Middle East leaders?
Yes.
I would say without any question, Sadat. Let me first of all explain our basic strategy. In 1969, when Nixon became president and I became security advisor, we faced a situation in which none of the major countries in the region had any diplomatic relations with us. There was a war along the Suez Canal that it was not a ground war, but it was Israeli retaliation against Egyptian incursions. And there were massive Soviet arms shipments into the region. We adopted a strategy which was to demonstrate to the Arab countries that they could get nowhere by Soviet arms and to make serious negotiations depend on separating, at least to a considerable extent, from the Soviet Union. And we maintained that position until the war broke out. I must say, we did not take Sadat very seriously. For a while I thought he was a character out of Aida, who was making terrible threats, which he never implemented. And in fact, he sent an emissary once, and we were talking at the end of his presentation. The emissary said, if we make progress, the president will invite you to Cairo. And I wrote on a note to the person who was sitting next to me on the American side, I said, do you think it would be impolite if I asked him what the second prize is? So when the war started, we decided that that was, in a way, the opportunity we had been looking for. We were absolutely determined to prevent any victory to be achieved by Soviet arms. But we also thought that having achieved this, we could use that demonstration to begin a peace process with the Arab side. And we sent a message to Sadat on the first day of the war saying, you're now making war with Soviet arms, but keep in mind that you have to make peace with American diplomacy. Now, whatever we did, the contribution of Sadat was that he understood that the question of peace with Israel was above all a psychological problem, that it was crucial for Israel to gain enough of a sense of security so that it could make the sacrifice that is inherent in giving up something permanent for something intangible, which is the essence of the peace process. And at various stages of the negotiations afterwards, he showed enough confidence in us. For example, some of you may remember that the war ended with the Egyptian Third Army trapped by actions that had taken place after the ceasefire had been in effect. So the big issue was what could be the first step towards peace. And the first time I saw Sadat after the end of the war, he asked me, what is your plan for making progress here? I said, you have two choices. You can insist on the road being opened, and we can probably get this. But then we will expend a lot of energy on something that does not affect the situation. Or we can take the time and develop a disengagement plan of withdrawal from the Suez Canal and establishing a demilitarized zone along it, and to begin the process of territory for peace. But for that, you have to keep the army where it is, and have it supplied through Israeli lines. So he said, I'll take the big solution, which meant that it had to sit there another 3 months, and that if the negotiations had failed, they would have been. So he made these decisions at every step of the way. At the same time, let me say a word about the Israelis. Golda Meir was looked like everybody's favorite aunt, except when you wanted to take 1 inch of Israeli territory away from her. She was a very tough negotiator, but one had to understand that a people that had suffered for every square mile of territory and that had no real margin of survival could not engage in experiments. So it was her obligation to conduct the peace process in a manner in which it was clear that these were painful decisions to be made. She could not afford the grand gestures that Sadat, with a huge territory, could afford to make. But to her enormous credit, while on every single issue it was extremely complicated to negotiate, she went the route on both the Egyptian and Syrian negotiations that led to, on the Egyptian side, to a peace process, and on the Syrian side, to a settlement that is still maintained today and that I don't think has been significantly violated by the Syrians. And I think of Golda with enormous affection and enormous respect.
I know I said this to you privately, and Charles reaffirmed it a few moments ago, but as a historian of the Middle East, there's no doubt that one of your greatest historic achievements was the change in Egypt and transforming Egypt from Soviet patron, Soviet ally to American partner in the pursuit of peace.
What I wanted to say, to the credit of Nixon, when we started down that road in 69, in retrospect, it looks inevitable. But we had to hang in there for 4 years before it happened, and that could not have been done without the president.
Let me connect the past to the present on the peace process. There was a time when it was clear what the strategic rationale for peacemaking was, turning Egypt from Soviet to American ally, for example. When you look at the Arab-Israeli situation today, how urgent, in your view, is the pursuit of Arab-Israeli peace?
The argument is always made that achieving Arab-Israeli peace will turn around the situation in the region and will remove the principal cause of disaffection of the radical Arabs. I have my doubts about that. And I have my doubts for this reason, whatever the final settlement is. And the curious thing about the Middle East is one knows pretty well what a final settlement would look like. I'll go back to that in a minute. Those who oppose it do so because they reject the existence of Israel and not the borders of Israel. So that the people who will be placated by this and who might be willing to accept it are going to come under immediate attack from the radicals for having given up that much. And I also believe that among the moderates, that those who are willing to make the agreement, they are probably divided between those who genuinely want peace and those who look at peace as a tactical device, ultimately to destroy Israel. Having said all of this, the issue therefore becomes, how can Israel best survive under conditions of a recognized settlement or under conditions of the status quo ameliorated? And I can see that that is a serious issue. I do not believe that a settlement will bring universal reconciliation in the region. I nevertheless believe that on balance, it is the wiser course to take, provided a number of circumstances are met, or conditions are met. First, let's understand what we mean by settlement. It's a strange aspect to the negotiation, which is this. When you begin most negotiations, normally, you don't quite know what the outcome will be. And the negotiation is supposed to bring about an outcome to which both sides can reconcile themselves or which they can endorse. In this negotiation, it is pretty clear what the outcome will be if it succeeds. What you don't know is which parties, how to find the parties to carry it out. On the Israeli side, it will be a searing domestic experience to go through the removal of significant numbers of Israelis from the West Bank. It's going to be a searing experience to the Israeli body politic, and it would require a leadership of truly extraordinary moral strength to carry this out without breaking the spirit of the Israeli people, without which the settlement loses its point. But at least in Israel, you can conceive how this could happen. But on the Arab side, it isn't clear to me where you get the security guarantees that prevent the West Bank from turning into a kind of Gaza, and in which rockets and other weapons and are concentrated. So I would think that one needs some kind of security system for the territory that is to be vacated by Israel that can be plausibly presented to the Israeli public as an at least conceivable alternative other than just the declarations of whatever ruler emerges. All the less so as no ruler has yet emerged. Secondly, if there is to be a peaceful settlement, there have to be some provisions in it that put an end at least to the government-sponsored propaganda against Israel. It would be necessary to have for the Arab population a vision that includes an Israel that is a permanent feature of the region, and not simply an Israel that, not as a state that is an intruder and a permanent violator of Arab rights. So these have to be components, in my view, of a negotiation. I think the border issues, those things are painful, but they could actually be settled, I think, fairly quickly if one could come to a solution of these other problems. But how to get to that, I have no quick idea.
It was once said by Sadat that America holds 99% of the cards. I want to ask you about something that touches probably everyone in this room, which is the impact in strategic terms of the financial crisis here in the United States, here in New York, and its implications for America playing the sort of leadership role that I know you envision for the United States in global affairs.
Well, let me give you a contradictory answer to this. I've thought about that in the last few weeks. On the one hand, I think we have overreached our capacities in the sort of leadership that we sometimes asserted for ourselves. We cannot simultaneously guarantee the security of the whole world and the domestic political structure of the whole world and engage ourselves actively in every country's domestic situation, as we sometimes implied in our rhetoric, not necessarily in our actions. So to adjust our purposes to our capabilities, it's not necessarily a bad thing. Other countries are now almost every place in the world analyzing a number of issues. One, those who invested in the United States face the political problem of explaining how they risked so much and on the basis of what theory. Secondly, it will raise questions, and I'm particularly talking about countries like China, for the decision-making process of these countries. Did we make the right decision in betting on cooperation with the United States? Third, they will probably become more assertive in bilateral negotiations because they feel stronger and because they will have somewhat less confidence in our competence. But having said all of this, this will also force them into a more realistic assessment and not simply shove every problem to the United States. They will now be obliged to consider what their real contribution has to be to international issues. So while on the one hand, in the short term, the impact is unfortunate, it is also a way to bring some of these countries to a perception of reality. And the same should be true of us. We are still going to be, when all of this is over, the strongest country in the world. We will still have the strongest military establishment and the strongest economy. We have made it a little bit too easy for ourselves in turning problems into technical issues in which we make grandiloquent goals and assign contributions to other societies of how they should participate in it. So we will be forced now to think in more achievable goals. But the fundamental principles I talked about at the beginning of what needs to be done, the need to prevent proliferation doesn't become any less because we find ourselves in a somewhat more difficult position. So I would think that with the right leadership here, we can actually turn this crisis into the beginning of a rebuilding of the international system that was in any event necessary and which has been obscured because we were divided in this country by too many extraneous considerations.
So if I, without putting words in your mouth, because I want you to ask, I want you to utter them yourself. Are you the one optimist in New York?
I think, I know this is unfashionable. I think this is a great opportunity to look at the international system. You look at countries around the world. Where are they going to go? The American vision of the global economic system was too out of whack with the political system. The internal restraints of the American system, and even the internal moral restraints of the American system in the economic world, were inadequate to the opportunities and possibilities that technology opened up to them. But having said all of this, the problems of this period nevertheless remain. And so, in some of the European countries, there's been a total lack of realism of what the function of the state could be or should be and what their international role should be. I believe that China will be shocked. It will have a serious domestic debate, at the end of which they will conclude that they need cooperation with the United States, as we will conclude that we will need cooperation with China and in a more modest but therefore more attainable framework. Yes, I'm optimistic, provided we do what we need to do.
Ladies and gentlemen, this year's Scholar Statesman Award has been awarded to a single honoree who is both scholar and statesman. And I believe over the last 45 minutes, we've had an opportunity to draw on an amazing breadth of experience and knowledge and insight about history, politics, diplomacy, international relations. And to end an evening like this, in a town like this, on an optimistic note for America and America's role in the world, I think we can only do that by drawing on this wisdom. So please join me in thanking Dr. Henry Kissinger.
Thank you. Thank you. Very nicely done.
That was excellent. Outstanding.